You have been watching the President of the United States. He is speaking in Davos. Obviously, you're not going to miss anything he says, okay, because we're going to be following this and covering his speech there. It's interesting because he's been ad-libbing, he's been rambling, but on many points, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, and obviously there's plenty for both, he has been surprisingly cogent and comfortable. I think that would be hard to disagree with. So what he's doing is, and I think the headline is, he's hitting Europe really, really hard as far as tariffs and as far as Greenland goes. Meanwhile, he's sending his envoys to Russia to meet with Mr. Putin. We're going to have that. The Americans have also turned down the other guy, Zelensky. No meeting for you, they say to Zelensky. Instead, they're going to announce another meeting with Mr. Putin. And Trump tells NATO, you are nothing without me. While Canada tells Trump, we're out. It's a whirlwind. On the Sanchez Effect, let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and this is The Effect. And I want to start today by doing something, look, I would normally not do, but something happened that I have to show to you because I think it's fascinating. I'm going to compliment CNN. Yes, I used to work there. You see, on CNN today, 90% of its coverage is biased against Russia. Just is. I don't mean critical. Critical is fine. It's perfectly fine to be critical. I'm talking about a bias that is careless, uninformed, and intentional. And if anybody knows that, it's Maria Zakharova. She is the spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry. You've probably seen her a million times. She is known for taking jabs, and that's exactly what she did when calling on a CNN reporter. Watch this.
So much has been said about the United States of America. I think it's fair to give the floor to American media. Please, I see CNN, right?
You were allowed to come here?
CNN, in the second row, yes? You can't believe your luck or what? Please, go ahead, ask your questions.
Please go ahead.
I'm very grateful. Thank you very much. Matthew Chance from CNN.
So here's the irony of that moment. As she's calling on the American reporter, she does so knowing full well that in the United States, right, my country, Russian journalists are not even allowed to step foot on a news conference. With Trump, there's a glimmer of hope that this could change, but generally speaking, Russian media, the Russian point of view, Russian journalists are banned, ixay nixay, in America. Yet here's Matthew Chance in Moscow. He's covering the Russian Foreign Affairs Ministry.
You've, Mr. Lavrov, repeatedly praised President Trump for understanding Russia's interests on the issue of Ukraine, for instance. But you've also criticized recent U.S. moves against Russian allies in Venezuela, in Iran, threats against Cuba, things like that. My question is, to what extent do you think that inconsistency, that unpredictability, that willingness to use unconstrained power by President Trump actually in itself represents a threat to Russia?
It's a surprising question. And here's what I mean when I say it's a surprising question. You see, if you follow this like I have, traditionally, questions from Western reporters, they lack context, and they're often loaded with accusations. But Chance's question is fair. Think about it. Asking Lavrov how he balances his praise for Trump on the one hand, while on the other hand criticizing him for Venezuela and for Greenland, that's a timely question.
At the beginning of our meeting in Riyadh, Marco Rubio expressed nearly the following. He stated that the foreign policy of the United States under President Trump is defined by national interests and common sense. This implies that the United States recognizes the existence of national interests among its leading partners, among all countries of the world, but especially its leading partners, other great powers. He then continued that the national interests of countries like the U.S. and Russia will not always align. In most cases, they won't align, but when they do, it would be a gross mistake not to use that alignment to negotiate and implement mutually beneficial solutions in economics, trade, investment, and more. In response, I said that I fully share this philosophy and logic, and I assume that the United States understands the validity of the approach outlined by Marco Rubio.
Item. Zelensky gets snubbed. There are a few things worse than getting stood up. Don't you hate it when that happens to you? We get all excited to meet somebody, and they don't even bother to show up. We've all been there, right? Well, for Zelensky, it's becoming a bit of a pattern lately. Once again, the Ukrainian strongman was scheduled to meet with U.S. officials, and once again, he was stood up. Davos, Switzerland is where some of the richest people in the world gather once a year. Look at this place. Beautiful, huh? Magnificent. They fly in their private jets, in their helicopters, wearing $1,000 ripped T-shirts to pretend to care about people issues that they generally really don't give a crap about. You know what's interesting? This year, though, Volodymyr Zelensky was excited to go to Davos, where he was expected to meet with President Trump. And their meeting has long been scheduled to finally talk about his particular security concerns. Now, I should tell you, by all accounts, Zelensky was very excited to go, no doubt wearing his one good ill-fitting suit, black, of course. But at the last minute, Mr. Trump called off the meeting. They called Zelensky and said, no, not on. Zelensky, as it turns out, is not going to Davos now. Look, it's been a tough week for Zelensky. Because of the Greenland threat, Ukraine is now on the back burner. His country has lost almost half of its power grid in the middle of winter. And now his very faithful European backers are more interested in talking to Russia than talking with him. Also, consider this. Part of that reason that Trump no longer wants to talk to Zelensky is because that rare earth minerals deal that Zelensky promised, well, those rare earth minerals, they don't really belong to him anymore. They're now in Russian control. Even Zelensky now admits he has too many big problems at home to be traveling.
Completing these documents is the last hurdle that remains. If the documents are ready, we will have a meeting and a trip. If there are packages, or even a meeting and a decision on additional air defense, of course I will go. But for now, I have a challenge in Ukraine, and it is very important for me to coordinate all services right now.
So much going on, adding insult to injury. Do you know who the Americans did meet with instead of Zelensky? The Russians. They met with a group led by Kirill Dmitriev. He's one of Russia's top diplomatic envoys. I met him recently. Interesting man. The Americans sent Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. And according to reports, the meeting was very successful. Whatever that means. All right, here's what Dmitriev says it means. He says it was very constructive, in fact. He says it was a closed-door meeting, and it revealed certain information that was passed on to the U.S. regarding a possible settlement on the Ukraine conflict. The underlying message, though, is clear. This is simple. Simple math, right? The Americans and the Russians are still talking. The Ukrainians are not talking. And you know what? We have just learned as well that the U.S. envoys are now going to fly to Moscow tomorrow, as we understand, where they're going to be meeting again, but this time not with Kirill Dmitriev, but with Russian President Vladimir Putin. I told you there's a lot of news. Then there's this, Europe. They, too, are now too busy with Greenland to be thinking about Ukraine. You see, Trump is threatening them, as you just heard in his speech in Davos. He's threatening them with massive tariffs if they don't succumb. He even went as far as saying that in typical Trumpian tone. Without me, there is no NATO. Is he right? I'll tell you what, it's a hell of a thing to say.
And yet I've done more to help NATO than any other president by far, than any other person. You wouldn't have NATO if I didn't get involved.
There's no NATO without Trump. NATO and the members of the EU as well, they are spinning in circles right now. You've seen them. We've been covering it. I mean, they don't know whether to appease Trump or insult Trump. The latest is they're going to challenge him with another tariff war, their own, as suggested by Germany's Friedrich Merz. That's his response, while French President Macron has just flat out come out and called Trump a bully, saying that Europe will not give in to bullies. And then, and what has to be, I think, pardon me for sharing this, but my opinion here. I think this has to be one of the most hypocritical comments uttered in decades. He, representing a country which is a colonial power and has been for centuries, is complaining about, are you ready for this? He's complaining about colonialism. Can he really look us in the eye and say that, even while wearing dark glasses?
Imperial ambitions are resurfacing. I would say to passively accept the law of the strongest, leading to vassalization and bloc politics. I think accepting a sort of new colonial approach doesn't make sense.
By the way, I wasn't the only one to make fun of his glasses. Mr. Trump just did as well. So, but glasses or no glasses, talk of a tariff war is once again spooking investors worldwide. Global markets have been tumbling. On Wall Street, the markets dropped like a rock, down something like 400 points. Investors are nervous, as they should be. Anytime you talk about tariff wars, the Dow is down almost 2 percentage points. The Nasdaq's down about 2.5 percentage points. But you know what? Maybe I was watching this last night. I'm fascinated by this guy. This guy. Right? Maybe the best perspective on all of this was provided by Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney. He's been in the news a lot in the last 48 hours. We're reaching out to him. We want him to be here on the show. I want to interview him because he's fascinating, I think. While most Europeans excuse the bombing of Iraq, the bombing of Iran, the bombing of Syria, Libya, Yemen, whatever, as nothing, they don't care. But now they're really angry about a threat on Greenland. This guy's different. He's more consistent. He seems to be saying, no, all of that is wrong. He seems to be saying the entire rules-based order narrative is bullcrap, a sham.
The rules-based order is fading. We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false, that the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient, that trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This fiction was useful, so we placed the sign in the window. We participated in the rituals, and we largely avoided calling out the gaps between rhetoric and reality. This bargain no longer works.
I got to share something else with you. Look at this. This is something one of the producers of our show here brought to my attention earlier today. And I looked at this and said, what the hell? Talk about a head turner. Look at this. Canada's armed forces have recently modeled a hypothetical U.S. military invasion of Canada. They're preparing for a potential invasion of Canada by the United States. The Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail reported this, seeing it right there in front of you, Tuesday. They're citing two senior government officials. It marked the first time in more than a century that the Canadian Armed Forces has developed a scenario specifically involving a potential military threat or assault from the United States. Okay, after the break, right here in the studio, we're going to be joined by somebody who knows a lot about these stories and the context, the perspective, the history of these stories. None other than Sergei Karaganov. He is an economic advisor who has not only advised Vladimir Putin, but he's also advised Boris Yeltsin. He understands the Russian situation. He understands the current conflict with Europe, both from a personal, intellectual, and historic perspective. I'm excited about being able to talk to him. He just had a long conversation with my dear friend Tucker Carlson, and now he's good enough to sit here with us. You'll see him in just a minute. Do not go away. Sergei Karaganov is good enough to join us. He's the honorary chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations and Defense Policy, the dean of the Faculty of World Economy and International Affairs at Moscow's Higher School of Economics. And those are titles, and we all like them. But more importantly is what makes a man important is his history, what he's done. And your history is fascinating. You were here from the beginning. You were here through the collapse of the Soviet Union. You were here and advised Boris Yeltsin, and you've also been advising the present president of Russia, Mr. Putin. That makes you, to me anyway, somebody who can share the knowledge that too many around the world don't understand. And not just because you read it or heard it on a podcast, because you lived it, right? Let's start with this. You made headlines recently, as I'm sure you know, all over the world, when you told my friend Tucker Carlson that Russia may have to eventually strike Europe. What did you mean by that?
Well, first of all, let me just correct you. I have been studying my work, writing pieces of speeches for Brezhnev. So for 50 years. Imagine how old I am.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes, and others. As to what I have been saying, I decided to open the question of possible Russian use of nuclear weapons about 2.5 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
Because I saw that our European neighbors have gone amok. They have lost the sense of history, have lost the sense of security. They are absolutely responsible. And to stop them, we have to go up the ladder of escalation, hopefully without actual use of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But we have to be ready for that. And of course, we send the signals also to the United States leadership through different channels. And by the way, Americans have started to withdraw from this bloody conflict with the West in Ukraine. I mean, even before Trump, because they understood that the stakes are on our side are very high. Now the question is how to persuade the insane, quote-unquote, European elites to come back to senses and to withdraw from this conflict. However, I think that they are not ready.
Are you heartened by the fact that recently, because of the Greenland debacle or threat or whatever we want to call it, we've seen overtures from Merz saying essentially he wants the largest nation, I'm trying to quote him, the largest nation in Europe to come back into the European community. Mr. Macron said he wants to meet with Putin all of a sudden. So did Meloni in Italy. And Finland is showing overtures that they want to be friendly with Russia once again, or at least try and talk to them. What do you? Did they get your message? Did they watch you on Tucker?
I think they can watch it. But I am very skeptical as to whether Russia want to return to Europe. Thank you. We have been in that. We have ended our, hopefully, our European journey, which have brought us a lot of useful things, like our great culture, which Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky wouldn't have happened without European influence. But Europe got us into a lot of trouble, especially for during the last century, but even before. They invaded us for five centuries. I mean, they were sources of actually of all ills in human history, including two world wars, multiple holocausts, etc. So when they're inviting us back, I say, okay.
But surely
no,
you're not.
Thank you. No, thank you. But of course, we want to have good relations with decent Europeans. We have to trade. We have to take parts of their accumulated fat. Americans are doing it extremely well now. But we will not return to quote-unquote Europe. We are becoming what we have to be, and we were destined by history. We are a great Northern Eurasian power, which is politically largely Asian, spiritually also largely Asian, because our Christianity came from Palestine, from Israel. Our Islam came from there, a little further there. Our Buddhism came even Easter. And our political system, we have taken from the Chinggis Khan Empire, though we defeated then, them in the end and freed themselves. But we are very much like they used to be. However, we are thankful for our European neighbors for what they have enriched us. But we have to have stopped that journey started by Peter the Great. I mean, about 150 years ago, our previous one of our czars, Alexander the Third, who is, I think, of whom Putin is very fond of, wanted to stop that journey, but we were unable. And then we got communism, and we got again two world wars, etc., etc. No, thank you. I mean, we will love some places in Europe. We know that there are friends, but I mean, crises and rot, which have been also coming from Europe, are not in our interests.
It's hard to understand why the antipathy, because it has been very serious. Mr. Putin, as you well know, I think it was in 2001 or something, reached out to the U.S. in the form of Condoleezza Rice, and he said, look, we want to join NATO. We want to be a part of you. We don't want to be your enemy. Let us in, and we'll be friends. It's like your neighbor coming to your house with flowers, and you shut the door on them because they seem to say, no, yet we want nothing to do with you. And you were the guy back then who said, this will eventually lead to a conflagration or conflict between Europe and the United States. You called it.
And between Europe and us.
Europe and Russia, I said.
Europe and Russia, yeah, yes.
I misspoke.
Well, I have persuaded Boris Yeltsin in 1992 to apply for NATO membership because at that time there was an opening. But he was rejected. When he was rejected, I was appalled because the offer was so generous. And I told my friends, the Council on Foreign Defense Policy and in the Russian establishment, they couldn't have rejected that. It is so stupid. Probably they want to do away with us, to deliver coup de grace. So let us smile and build up our strength. When Mr. Putin came and he applied for the second time, I was already skeptical, but he tried, and he failed.
Is he too patient?
After that, absolutely, he is too patient. after that, everything started. After the rejection, and then of course when President Bush rejected American participation in the anti-ballistic missile treaty. The decisions were made within Mr. Putin's mind and with our mind that we are that the conflict is inevitable. I have been writing and telling
conflict is inevitable.
Inevitable.
You think Putin believes that?
He didn't want a war. Clearly, and he doesn't want, still wants to stop the war. But the conflict was inevitable since 1994 when NATO started to expand.
Is that why Mr. Putin recently said, we don't want war, but if it's war you want, we'll give it to you, and then followed up with an Oreshnik missile?
Yes. And he said, and he's progressing, quote unquote, in a very simple way, at first. When people like myself were telling that eventually, if absolutely needed, though God forbids, we have to punish our European neighbors with nukes. I hope that wouldn't happen, and I pray that it wouldn't happen. He disagreed. But now, very recently, they changed our Russian nuclear doctrine, lowering the nuclear threshold. And very recently, I think a month and a half ago, he said that if Europe continues and starts a war against Russia, there'll be nobody in Europe to talk to. And that means he threatened nuclear annihilation. I know he doesn't want that. And I hope and I hate the idea. Mm-hmm. But the question is that our European neighbors, not all, of course,
right,
they are running amok, as they have done many times in history.
There's a lot of people watching us from around the world. This show is seen by millions and millions of people. There's a lot of people watching us in the UK, and they're watching us in Australia. We get comments from there all the time. They're watching us as well in Europe, and most certainly in the United States. I'm an American. And I know this. A lot of people hear what you're saying and think that you're threatening Europe without cause, because a lot of them don't understand what MI6 has done in the United States, I mean, in Russia, pardon me, what the CIA has done. They don't know, perhaps, about the City Hall attack that the Russians were able to link to the West. They don't know about Russian generals assassinated, about train derailments. There have been so many things that have been direct attacks on Russia that have come from the West that the West doesn't know about because it's not reported there. And I think that's what you're getting at when you say, how much can Mr. Putin take, right?
Exactly. And unfortunately, well, as you might know, I have been one of the founders of the Institute of Europe. I was a specialist on the United States. I got rid of my illusions in the 90s. Probably President Putin have had some illusions. I mean, it's late. Now he has no illusions. The question is now how to stop Europe from being Europe, the source of all evil and aggression in the world, colonialism, racial hatred, I mean, racism, multiple genocides. Not all Europeans. I have many friends there, and I like some of the countries and some like of the places. But Europe has been the source. They have sucked your country, United States, several times in bloody conflicts. You saved them for nothing. By the way, what we had to suffer Europe on our necks. Europe has been a threat for 500 years. It has to be pushed away from the world scene at last.
Is it because Russia has so much? Because when you look at it on paper, this is, you know, Russia's a country like any other country, but there are certain facts that are just undeniable. Russia is the largest country on the planet. Russia has more hydrocarbons than any country in the planet. Russia has perhaps more rare earth minerals than any country, with the exception of China, in the planet. Timber, an economy that is without fail, an army that seems to be as capable as any in the world, according to the proof we're seeing now. It's hard to look at Russia and not want to maybe take it over, end it, stop it. Is that what it is? Is it envy or just greed?
Partially, it is envy, but mostly it has been greed. We saw that for at least several centuries. So we are used to that. You know, but we have had many illusions, as you know, since Peter the Great, that Europe was a source of humanism. I mean, Europe is not, has not been a source of humanism. It is a source of hatred, racial colonialism, aggression. Though, of course, as I've said, I mean, Europe is multifaceted. And there are many countries in Europe which I think could be brought back to census.
Hungry.
But we have to do, not only.
Yeah.
I mean, let's put it this way. The worst in Europe is the colonist West and North. I mean, people of the South and Central are generally more sensible. They're generally culturally more open. And hopefully, sooner or later, they will join in a great Eurasian concert of nations, but not countries of the Northern Western Tier.
Is there any question in your mind that Ukraine is simply a tool that is being used by bankers around the world, including some of the oligarchs that got their asses kicked out of Russia by Mr. Putin went elsewhere and then said, we want to get back at Putin and we'll do it through Ukraine. Is that argument sound or am I full of crap?
It is a sound argument, but also... Ukraine was at one point used, sorry to say that to you, American, as an American tool from 2003, especially 2004, to stop a possibility or curtail a possibility of a continental-wide alliance. Russia and Germany would join. And that was exactly the point when American inner circles started to pump up the Ukrainian problem. The first coup d'etat in Ukraine started in 2004. And since that time, I mean, we have started an inevitable slide down towards a direct confrontation. I hoped, however, that it would avoid that, but we failed.
But here we have Mr. Trump now, basically, it looks to me, and maybe I'm overspeaking here, favoring Russia. He's not talking to Zelensky. He's talking to Russia again and again and again. Tomorrow, there's going to be a meeting in Moscow here between the envoys, Witkoff and Kushner, and Mr. Putin again. It looks to me like the Americans are sending a message to the world, and especially to the Europeans, that I'm more with Russia than I am with Ukraine, and I may even be more with Russia than I am with you guys. What does that do to the world order?
Well, first of all, I mean, the world order has collapsed. I mean, it has been collapsing since approximately mid-2000s.
Yeah.
So now it is in full collapse, and we should think about what we should build on the ruins of the former world order. We are not yet ready to talk about that. As to Mr. Trump, he has good instincts. He wants America strong.
Yeah.
He wants America affluent, and for that, maybe quite a few Americans, even before him, understood that being a globalist hegemon was costing too much.
Hmm.
That started actually in 2000s, but it was underneath. And then it came in the open with the first Trump presidency. Then he was defeated by the globalists, comprador or whatever, mm-hmm. cosmopolitan parts of American elite. Now he's showing the way for America to be great again, but great again as a Western Hemisphere power with a global reach, of course, but not a global hegemon as it used to be, because a global hegemon was a small episode in American history, and actually it brought a lot of shame and a lot of losses to the United States, especially to its moral standing in the
world.
But
he still has some hegemonious thinking people around him who are trying to convince him that he should attack Russia and he should attack China and he should do a lot of crazy things.
And that's why people like myself on this side and with my Chinese friends are saying.
Are you a hardliner? Do you consider yourself a hardliner in Russia?
I'm a realist, but I'm very hardline. That's why. Because I have been...
Much more than Putin.
Yeah, of course.
Now, did you tell him? Have you told him that?
Yes.
You've told him?
And he knows.
You told him you're too patient, you're too weak, you need to be stronger.
Of course,
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Absolutely. That means that we have to roughly deter, first of all, and even morally, hopefully without using of military force, defeat Europe, because Europe is a source. And we have to roughly deter the United States, because it has still these hegemonic ambitions, and a lot of people you have mentioned still thinking about, I mean, globalist role, about defeating Russia, China, etc. But we are moving in the right direction. And this right direction would lead us, hopefully, if we do the right things, avoid great thermonuclear
yeah.
war.
Yeah.
We will lead to a world where, say, four great powers would lead the world towards a better to the better order. These four powers are obvious. Europe is not among them.
Exactly. So here's my question to you then, and I want you to think long and hard about this. Europe is in a weaker state today than it ever has been in your lifetime, right?
Absolutely, but even, I would say, not in only that, for about 500 years, yes.
Then if that's the case, and Europe is weaker now than it's ever been, is this the time to attack or befriend?
Come on.
Which is the better strategy?
Absolutely. I mean, why on earth do we have to attack? Europe is a source of problems.
Yeah.
And it will be more a source of problems because it is disintegrating. It will be, they will again be as at each own throes as they have been throughout the history.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea is, of course, we have to trade, we have to keep cultural ties, etc. But we have to go as far away from the European disease as possible, taking with us, of course, the great literature which we have also inherited from Europe, great music, because we wouldn't have Tolstoy and Dostoevsky without European influence. We wouldn't have Tchaikovsky or Mussorgsky without European influence. We shall keep that. We'll keep Beethoven and Chopin with us. But, I mean, let them, I mean, boil in their own sauce, which tastes or smells worse and worse.
I find Vladimir Putin fascinating in so many ways. And one of the things that fascinates me so much about him is that he's disliked so much by the West and ill-treated generally by the Western media. And yet, in many ways, if you just look at it on paper, forget Putin, take his name out of it and just say, look at what's happened to Russia from the end of the Soviet Union to now, where it kind of went way downhill, and under Mr. Putin's leadership, it's actually done quite well, right? On paper, if you just look at GDP, if you look at employment, if you look at approval ratings, if you look at all those things, and he's thrown out a lot of the bad people, who are some of the people who are now trying to attack him from other countries. But how would you characterize Mr. Putin as the leader of this country over the past so many years?
Well, history will say. But I remember that in 1999 I was a part of a movement to oust the rule of the oligarchs. When he came, at first I was against him because I thought he was one of those. But when he came to power, I came to a very definite conclusion that the Almighty had excused Russia for the sin of communism and many other sins, and that he is sent by the Almighty. I told him in his face about that. Now, whether he agrees with that, not, I think he agreed, but he never would admit that, of course.
What's he like? What's he like? Is he a simple man? Does he? I heard he never sleeps.
Let's put it this way. I am not his advisor.
Right.
I am not his inner circle.
You just know him.
I'm looking from outside. He's a man of his generation. I think I would even disagree on some of his infatuations with, former infatuations with Europe and the West. Because I lost that infatuation earlier than him. I told him once publicly about that. He is progressing very fastly, and it's unbelievable that he's my age and he's progressing very fastly. But when I think about him, I say, be tougher.
Be tougher.
Yes.
We just learned, by the way, I was just told by one of my producers that Mr. Zelensky will, after all, be traveling to Davos. Originally, we had just reported we wanted to make sure that there's an update on that.
We're told now he will be traveling to Davos. That doesn't mean that he's going to sit down and talk to Mr. Trump. We don't know if that's changed or any of Mr. Trump's advisors. What do you make of him? What do you make of Volodymyr Zelensky? Who is this guy?
Let's put it this way. I mean, I think he doesn't deserve our attention. He's a figure. Oh, by the way, a talented actor or a talented comedian who was put by history in his place. He deserves some respect because he hasn't yet broke, I mean, completely. Mm-hmm. But he's a puppet of his oligarchic class, and he's a puppet of his oligarchic and plutocrats from outside. So, and he's not a leader of the country because he dislikes and does not respect Ukraine. And that is clear.
You think he's given it up? You think he's allowed Ukraine, his people, to be used?
Listen, what this elite, which brought him to power, has done to Ukraine, and I have been, I knew most of the people, or the previous elite, not Mr. Zelensky. They had a chance of building a state and a prosperous state out of Ukraine. Instead, they robbed it from the beginning to the end. Ukraine does not have a state-building elite. And so these are clowns. Now, of course, because of war, some of them are becoming tougher. But I do not see any hope for Ukraine as a state. I hope I'm wrong.
Let's make some news here if we can. Odessa. Odessa is a city by all historic understanding that is more Russian than it is Ukrainian. And many of the people there consider themselves so. And historically, of course, everything is there that signals Catherine the Great and everything else having to do with Russia throughout its history. So here's the question. Do you think the Russians in this position now, obviously winning this war, will continue on to Odessa and liberate or conquer Odessa, use your term? And should they? Would you like to see it?
I am not one of the fans of Mr. Trump's proposals, though I understand that he means peace.
It's peace proposals.
Peace proposals. It is a piecemeal solution which does not solve the problem. It will be an armistice. The real problem is, of course, the fact that European elites, because of their multiple and failures, are pushing hostility and war to the front of the agenda. The fact that they're actually preparing themselves for war is absolutely abysmal idiocy, because if it comes to war, there'll be no Europe. But they have been doing. The problem is Europe. As to the territorial issue.
Yes.
I believe that, so it is still now, it will be, hopefully, some kind of a piecemeal deal and narcissist, and I think that is useful.
Russia gets the four oblasts
liberated. And also we will stop, sacrificing our best men, which is very important. Mm-hmm. But if this problem is not solved, the problem of Europe, we will have to, the war will be restarted.
The war will be what?
Restarted.
Restarted.
By other means. And then the question, at least in our analysis, would be that Russia will have to escalate closer to the nuclear level to push Europeans aside, and then probably take over, return some of the southern and eastern areas which are purely Russian. But I do not want Russia, and from the beginning, to take over the whole of Ukraine, because Ukraine, parts of Ukraine, especially central and western, are not quite Russian. And
no,
here right. I disagree with Mr. Putin, who said that we are one people. I mean, there are. And second, I must say that we do not need that. They have been a burden on the neck of the Soviet Union. They have been their biggest swallower of subsidies within the former Soviet mm-hmm. Union. And these central and western areas of Ukraine have been on subsidies within Ukraine, because the productive areas of Ukraine, mostly productive, are in the east and south. And I'm not racist at all, but that is a fact of history. Yeah. We do not want to take them over, and we do not want to take them back. But if needed, and if there would be a massacre, et cetera, we will have to deal with that.
And if it happens, they're a small, landlocked country, and I'm not sure Europe is interested in
it. Let it be. There are, in principle, I mean, there are landlocked countries in Europe which could prosper. The problem is not is it landlocked. It is that it does not have a state-building elite, a responsible, patriotic elite. It does not have one. Mm. Or hasn't had. Maybe during this war they will build up something, but I'm not sure whether they could build a, not only patriotic or even chauvinist elite, but also constructive elite which could rebuild the country. So far, they have been failing through these 30 years, I mean, from the beginning to the end. They have inherited their richest and part of the former Soviet Union, and they made it the probably the poorest part of the former Soviet Union.
Let me press you, Mr. Kargonov, on the question of using any type of nuclear power against Europe, something you have mentioned on several occasions. And you said it might come to that if they keep pushing, if they keep doing what they're doing, if they keep threatening. What do you mean by that? What exactly, explain to our viewers, what exactly would it take for Russia to get to that pain threshold where they have to actually do that?
If Europeans continue to support
Ukraine,
to pop up, not Ukraine, this war.
The war.
They are not, it's not about Ukraine. It's war about against Russia. They're using Ukraine as cannon fodder. And there's nothing to do. And I remember very well that I have been cautioning at that time that we were still friendly with American, when Americans and Europeans have been telling it, if you push Ukraine in that direction, you're condemning them to millions of deaths.
Yes.
That has happened already. Ukrainians.
So to be clear, you're saying Europe is already at war with Russia?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. And we yet, of course, are not openly acknowledging that officially, but it is clearly, it is the third big war of Europe against Russia. One was Napoleon. Mm-hmm. There were smaller wars before, but Napoleon came with 20 languages, and then Hitler came with 95 countries of Europe behind him. I mean, Britain avoided the saw that fate because Hitler made a fantastic mistake, one of the worst in history, when he invaded, decided to invade Soviet Union before Britain. Otherwise, Britain would have been Germanized too.
Yeah.
But there were only two countries in Europe which were not participating in the directly or indirectly in the Hitler's invasion. These were former Yugoslavia and Greece.
Hmm.
Now, others well supplied arms, people, etc. Even the French, of course, who were our allies, sent several divisions to the Russian front. And they were the last to defend Reichstag when Russian troops came to Berlin. So we all remember that. Unfortunately, And now this history comes back. And we have to face it again and just to remind ourselves that Europe has been the source of most wars and the worst tragedies in human history.
But to leave this on a positive note, I see signs, maybe you don't, and you have a lot more history than me. And as an American, we tend to look at things in a 24-hour period, unfortunately. And you, as I just saw, do something that's very Russian. You look at everything through the lenses of history. You really do. And it's not just you. It's many of the smart people that I talk to in Russia. But at least in the past month, I have seen things that I didn't think I'd see. I see a German chancellor saying, I want to make Russia part of Europe again. I want to go back and make amends with Russia. I see Europeans saying the same thing. I see an American president essentially saying, I want to welcome Russia back in somehow, even though there are people in his country that are fighting him. There are good, positive signs right now of the things that you say we must do to avoid this conflagration to happen. Do you see those too?
Yeah, see, these signs on the American side.
Mr. Trump.
Yeah, Mr. Trump said, and even before, because Trump is a reflection of deep changes in the balance of American history interests. Of course, as to Europeans, and yes, we have very, very many ties to restore some of them, but no, thank you, not anymore. We are fed with them, so what we should do is to return where we belong, and that is that we are a great Eurasian country.
China, India, right?
China, India, Persia, Turkey. We are politically Asian. We are socially Asian. Culturally, we are European, and we love.
Our culture.
But why on earth should we return to this dustbin of history?
Dustbin of history.
Yes. I mean,
strong words, sir.
It's not. Not all of my compatriots would agree with me.
Yes, but.
But I mean, more and more agree because. When we were telling them that it is dustbin of history 20 or 25 years ago, before that I was also a Europhile, they were rejecting us. But now they see that it is dustbin of history. However, I mean, they are close culturally. They're still affluent economically. Why not trade with them? Why not deal with them on a human level, though? As you know, Europeans are forbidden to talk to Russians.
Yeah, I know. So are Americans.
Americans, but still Americans have a bit more of a room for maneuver. But Europeans are simply could risk their careers or else for talking, and they have many friends who are clandestinely sending me notes. I mean, hello, we're still friends, and I'm clandestinely, not to jeopardize them. I mean, sending notes, I mean, through other means. It's unbelievable. It is simply, by the way,
yes,
that has never been in history, except for during this kind of a separation.
Yes.
I mean, the Iron Curtain, which had been built on even on the human terms from the European side, was had never been in during Soviet Western confrontation. We still, I mean, had a lot more channels of communication, a lot more friendships, more cultural exchanges. It was difficult, unpleasant, but it was not forbidden.
It kind of fits, I think, in many ways, what I heard from Mr. Lavrov yesterday. I think he's more trusting of the Americans, although not totally, because he knows that administration changes, but he still doesn't trust the European perspective, even the handshake at this point. Sergei Karaganov, wow. He has advised Mr. Putin. He has advised Mr. Yeltsin and Mr. Brezhnev. Wow, what a story. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. But they are not responsible for my advice.
I'll call them and let them know.
Yes,
oh, absolutely. My God. Thank you so much.
It
we so much appreciate
it was a
you coming in and giving us this historical perspective and your very educated perspective on where the world is right now, because we're going through a hell of a time. Pardon me for using the vernacular in that case. That's it for us. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate the fact that you've been following us so much lately. Oh, and all the comments. We don't get a chance to share some of the comments with you, but we're getting thousands of them from you, obviously. You can find me on YouTube. You can find me on Twitter. We're on Twitter, I'm Rick Sanchez TV. On YouTube, it's called Journalistically Speaking with Rick Sanchez. And thank you, really, for letting us into your homes. And we'll be looking for you again next time.